How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It's Tuesday, August 31st, 2010, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We have tons of stuff to talk about today, including the 900th anniversary of Raw. And first off, Dave, how you doing today?
Yeah. We can change that subject.
let's talk about Raw.
It's been a terrible week.
It has been a horrendous week, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been a bad week for both of us.
Yeah. So, at least Raw was not terrible.
Nah, but it, I don't know. It really, I wasn't really, like, into it that much.
It was not very special.
I think that about the 45th time that they told me that they had done more episodes than Cheers and some other shows combined, I was just like getting so sick of it. And it's like say it once, that's cool. But I know someone in the company that was just going, God, did the company come off as insecure or what? And it's like, you're telling me?
That was not the only insecurities that they expressed on this particular show.
Oh my God! But it's like okay, pat yourself on the back for 900 episodes. That's an impressive feat in television. It's not unprecedented. This longest running whatever that they're saying they are is, everyone knows that's never been true. And if you keep saying something over and over again, it's been like a Vince McMahon catchphrase. So you say it over and over again, and people start to believe it. But it's not even the longest running wrestling show. Let alone the longest running anything else show.
It was one thing when they just called it, I think they used to call it like the longest running episodic television show in history or something like that.
Weekly episodic, because there were daily soap operas that are episodic that ran for 100 years.
But the point was, it really annoyed me.
But it wasn't that either.
It really annoyed me in the beginning of the show when they said, and this is a direct quote, this is a direct quote here, that Raw had, quote, more episodes than any television show in history. That is a blatant lie. There's absolutely no way you can even begin to spin that.
Think about how many episodes the Tonight Show's had.
Certainly a hell of a lot more than 900.
Yeah, and Meet the Press.
I actually looked it up.
52 weeks a year going back. I couldn't tell you how many years. 60 Minutes, 52. I don't know. They may do. I don't even know if they do reruns of 60 Minutes. But.
All I know is that in terms of total episodes, they have not yet reached the Jenny Jones Show. They have not yet reached America's Most Wanted. Soul Train has more episodes than Raw. X-Play.
Brian, there's probably 10 professional wrestling shows that have more episodes than Raw.
Sure.
At least. Wrestling at the Chase was weekly from 1959 to 1983.
Yeah.
Actually, Vince used the name Wrestling at the Chase even for a year or two there. But Wrestling at the Chase was 24, 25 years. They're not, they're 17 years. And they'll beat it, most likely, but they haven't. World Championship Wrestling, which started as Georgia Championship Wrestling in 1972, was on the air for 28 years. Portland Wrestling was probably on the air close to 40 years. Houston Wrestling was on the air 38 years. I'm sure there's others.
List goes on and on.
It's just, you're not even the longest running show in your own genre, let alone the history of television.
Couldn't they just say the longest running Monday night wrestling show?
Local shows, which they never specify, local and national. The Atlanta show was on cable, which they're on cable, and it started on cable in 1976 till 2000. So it's still 24 or 25 years.
How about the longest running Monday night wrestling show with consecutive episodes?
Well, it's that.
So we got something there.
It's absolutely that.
Anyway.
It's the longest running show that Vince McMahon's produced.
That's true.
Yeah.
So Bret Hart came out and opened up the show talking about how he was there for Raw at the beginning. He didn't think it was going to last 17 years, but lo and behold, it did, and it was doing pretty well.
I got a question. Wasn't it 2 weeks ago when the mystery general manager said that Bret Hart would never be back?
Well, that was explained later.
Oh, what did he say? I missed that explanation, I guess.
Well, the explanation was the GM basically said, despite past reservations, he was going to have Bret on the show. That was the only explanation they had.
Okay, because it was only 2 weeks ago when they said he would never be back.
Yeah, I think the idea was the GM never wanted to see him wrestle again, but he was allowed on the show. And then today, the GM decided, well, I will have him wrestle The Undertaker, I guess because the GM's a heel. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, he called out Undertaker, since Undertaker was the only other guy he said that had been there since the beginning. And instead, Kane came out. And Kane talked about how he didn't want to be in his brother's shadow and this and that, and how Undertaker had retired Shawn Michaels, an icon at WrestleMania, and so therefore he needed to retire an icon, and his icon was going to be Bret Hart. And he grabbed him for a choke slam. The Harts came out. Kane beat them up like geeks. Bret started to make a comeback. Kane grabbed him. Lights went out. Came back on. Undertaker was in the ring. They had a brief brawl, and then Kane bailed outside. And at that point, the GM announced that despite past reservations, he was going to have Bret Hart work tonight, and he was going to work against The Undertaker. And that was your opening segment. Undertaker looked very old.
Hold on just a second. I have to switch phones.
Sure.
Okay.
There we go. So that was the opening segment there. We had clips, as they always do, from various Raws over the years. We had clips from the very first Raw. We had clips of Austin with the beer truck. And they went from clips of Steve Austin in 1998 to Kofi Kingston, Michael McGillicuddy, and Caval. I'm sorry, it was a three-way tag. It was Caval and McGillicuddy. Caval and Daniel Bryan. Against Kofi and Michael McGillicuddy against Miz and Alex Riley. And only Miz and Alex Riley got an entrance. The other guys were just in the ring like dorks.
I thought that Daniel Bryan, you know, like, I mean, his wrestling was good, but just the way he was presented made him look like a geek.
Well, he was presented as a geek until, thankfully, the end, when Caval hit the double foot stomp on, and then Miz flew in out of nowhere, hit the skull-crushing finale for the pin. And afterwards, Miz laid out Bryan with the briefcase, celebrated with Riley, so they're still pushing the Bryan versus Miz match for the U.S. title. But he should absolutely, 100%, have gotten an entrance for this match, and he didn't, probably because the opening segment went too long.
Yeah, probably. I thought the opening segment was real good.
You know, I got to say one thing about this show that's actually a positive. Every time they do one of these special shows, they have clips from the past, and without question, the past always looks so much better than the present. Hotter crowds, bigger stars, whole nine yards. I will say that at least this time, when they were showing classic clips of the past 17 years or whatever, they had a lot of clips from the past 5 years. So at least they were trying to tell people that Raw today is just as cool as it was during the peak. I don't know if it worked, but they tried.
Yeah, I would say they tried, but I think that the one thing was is that it also came across that nobody, you know, because it's the case, that nobody they had was anywhere near a star at the level of Austin and Rock, which is interesting because they did never show any Hogan or Flair, you know. Flair was a star, but, I mean, Hogan was a big star even, you know, when it, you know, at times on Raw, but Austin and Rock would probably be the two biggest stars of the Raw era, and I felt that they came off as, you know, bigger stars than anyone they had, for sure. Especially with the insanity of John Cena wearing that T-shirt, especially since that had been a topic of discussion during the week. You know, that, but I mean, on that one, the T-shirt deal, I think that the deal was is that they didn't care if he got booed in his home city as long as they thought that if he wore the T-shirt out there, that it would help sell T-shirts. So that was obviously the way Vince made the call. And, you know, I mean, whatever. It's fine. You know, he wants to stop babyface boot out of the building in his hometown.
Weren't we just talking about that with Saturday night when the top babyface, well, obviously it wasn't booked, but he, you know, he was a hero. And the people went nuts for it.
No, this is different. This is the hometown guy wearing the colors of the Los Angeles Lakers.
Well, sure.
Which are like, you know, the biggest sports rival for the Boston Celtics for decades. You know, God, I mean, the Lakers-Celtics rivalry, God, I think that goes back to the 60s. So maybe before that, I don't know. I remember it from the late 60s. So, you know, the idea of the T-shirt itself was already bad enough, but when he came out and that wearing those colors and those people started booing, it was just like, this was a really interesting call. You know, I'm not saying it was the wrong call. I just thought it was an interesting call.
But again, we also had the incident of the guy, and actually I liked the booking of the main event. But again, John Cena, the hometown guy, beaten in the main event.
Yeah, but he wasn't, you know, the main event lacked heat because nobody you knew to cheer for, because you had Sheamus in there, who's a heel. You had Cena in there, who everybody thought took as a heel. You had Nexus, who were all heels. The only person they liked was Randy Orton.
We had Lay Cool come out for a match with Eve and Melina. It went about a minute. Melina knocked Michelle off the apron, rolled up Layla for the pin, and afterwards they did the big promo saying that...
they're going to unify the titles.
Yep. Unification match at Night of the Champions. Melina said she'd accept it under one condition, that being that it was a lumberjack match. So, we've got a lumberjack unification match.
I understand why they did it, but it was so weird when she said it, because I'm going like, okay, and why?
There's no good explanation for it.
I mean, it's not even because of what you do. I'm going to make a lumberjack match. Well, what do? You guys interfere, so I'm going to have tons of people interfering.
Well, the idea would have been that they would have screwed Melina in this match due to interference, and thus Melina would announce lumberjacks for the match?
No. What you would do to build up a lumberjack match is that they would lose by countout instead of by pinfall, because they ran away.
I see.
And then you'd go, I'm going to, do a lumberjack match, so you girls get thrown back in.
Hmm.
They didn't even bother. They just, I guess it doesn't matter, because, the whole idea of the lumberjack match was just so, they could get all the women standing at ringside on the show and kind of get them all on the show for whatever reason. God only knows why we need, 10 women surrounding the ring for a women's singles match to, not make it any better.
Had a NXT meeting backstage. I thought they came off horribly here. They're all facing the camera in an uncomfortable manner. Their acting is horrible. They look like dorks. They talk about how Skip Sheffield broke his ankle. And Wade said if anybody thought they were weak, they should think again. He said he was going to do something tonight that would have people talking forever. And suffice to say, he didn't.
Yeah.
His original plan was a complete failure. Jericho then did a promo, and he said he needed to take matters in his own hands, prove he was the best of all time. He said if he did not win the WWE title and Night of Champions, he was leaving, and it would be the last you'd ever see of Chris Jericho in WWE. And Josh actually called him on it, saying, listen, you've been kicked off or threatened to leave a dozen times now.
How many times did he lose? He'll never be back on Raw matches, probably. It seemed like it was every other week for a while there.
It was like the Bret Hart storyline of him supposedly wrestling.
Yeah.
So Jericho told him to shut up and said he was going to prove to everyone tonight why he was the best in the world at what he did. And he also did not stand up to his word there.
Yeah. He's got the contract deal going on, and the contract does expire in a couple weeks.
Well.
So I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm sure now that this is an angle that if he does sign, he's going to keep it quiet. But I do know as of a week ago he had not signed, and it had been something negotiated. It didn't. The impression I have is that he was not looking to leave. There's something, and I was not told this specifically. There's an impasse that they're at. I'm thinking it's number of dates, because he wants dates to he wants days off to tour with his band and days promote his book and things like that. And so I think that's the impasse. I don't know that that's for sure the impasse, but there is an impasse, or at least there was as of a week ago. And what that means, I don't know. I mean, originally, Chris Jericho was not scheduled to win this match. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't and leave, or maybe he won't and he'll be back on Raw 2 weeks later, like The Miz.
Yeah.
When The Miz was kicked off of Raw.
Dashing Cody Rhodes and Drew McIntyre against Morrison and R-Truth to determine number one contenders. This went 1 minute, broke down into a brawl. The ref threw it out. This sucked.
I have no idea what that was about.
I presume they ran out of time yet again.
I think that it was one of those things where they had so much on the show because they wanted to get all the SmackDown guys on television. And, what was the point of that? I mean, it's like a number one contenders match, and then you do a no contest.
I guess it'll be a three-way at the pay-per-view, maybe. I don't know.
Could be. Yeah.
Bret and The Undertaker, before the bell rang, of course, out came Wade Barrett. Said this match will never happen. So he called it.
Mm-hmm.
Said it was the 900th Raw, and his plan to do something unforgettable was to take them both out by himself. So he jumped in the ring and went after Undertaker, got his ass kicked. And then suddenly the lights went out. Undertaker's gong sounded, and when they came back on, Brett had disappeared and Kane was in the ring. So they brawled a bit, the lights went out, came back on, Kane was gone. Then the Nexus came out, surrounded the ring, they're about to kill Undertaker, and he started running wild on all of them, but then the gong sounded again, lights went out, came back on, Wade had Taker up, hit him with his finish, and then they had Gabriel give him the 450. Taker tried to sit up, but could not. His powers are gone, you see. And all I know is I watched this and I thought, you know, if I had faith that they were going to explain why the lights kept going out and where the hell Bret Hart went, why he just disappeared and was never seen again. And
the general manager realized that he was banned and forgot to, just remembered.
So the general manager can now make men disappear at will?
I do not know.
All I know is I have no faith that they're going to explain this.
No, they're not.
Great.
I'm sure they're not going to explain this. I mean, think about this. All the times that the lights have gone off in every promotion historically, I mean, it's been years since it's ever been explained. It's just the lights go off, and that means that, like, some new guy is debuting. Except in this case, it was just not that.
At least if it's like the lights go out and Undertaker appears and disappears, that happens all the time. He's the Undertaker. We have to pretend that he is able to turn off the lights and appear and disappear at will. That's fine. But where did Brett go? Why?
Maybe Brett's been studying magic. He's been off for 12 years.
I see. So that's what he was doing in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Studying magic.
They never named
that.
Wade Barrett's finishing move.
What was that?
They named Wade Barrett's finishing move something like Wasteland or something.
Waste management?
Is that what it was?
I don't know. I
think it was Wasteland or something. Something to do with waste.
Not something to do with Wade?
Waste. You know, like laid to waste or something.
Sure. We had Jack Swagger and Evan
Bourne. Wasteland or something.
The Wasteland, yeah.
Yeah.
Swagger and Bourne, match was just starting when Alberto Del Rio came out with his car, honking the horn, and his ring announcer. This was a point where I was like, this show is horrendously overwritten. They went from having no time to write...
It was way overbooked, that's for sure.
They went from having no time to write Raw to having, like, an extra week, and this is what we got. So Cole was going nuts, talking about how he loved this guy. They had a split screen. So on one side, Alberto is walking to the ring. On the other side, Evan Bourne is making a comeback on Jack Swagger. This was straight out of WCW. Swagger ended up moving out of the way of the Shooting Star, clipping his leg, ankle lock submission. And then Del Rio cut a promo saying that Ray would not be there tonight. He was in the hospital. What he had done to him was phenomenal. And the only thing he was sad about was that the people on Raw never got a chance to see it. So he said he was going to go recreate it right now on Evan Bourne. He put Evan in the cross arm breaker. He threw him in, out of the ring. He was about to break his arm with a chair when Mark Henry made the save and ran off Alberto. I'm a big fan of Alberto. I've only seen him in the ring one time, and it did not light my world on fire. But outside the ring, I thought he's been very good.
I'm amazed at how much they've gotten out of him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they've done a great job of introducing him. They've done a great job on those vignettes. And he walks around and does have that aura of a star, which is you know, sometimes not the easiest thing, and most guys don't have it. So, yeah, that part's pretty good, and, you know, they're lighting the rocket under him. I don't know what the Mark Henry thing is, and that may, you know, they're on different brands, so maybe they'll do one match, but, boy, if they do an extended program, that may not help them.
No, it will not.
It won't help his upward mobility, whether he wins or loses.
I don't need to see that match ever. Punk came out with his wacky crew, and he said that he was going to talk about who he was better than. Said he was better than The Rock, because he did not drink, smoke, or make horrible movies like The Tooth Fairy. Said he didn't miss The Rock, because Rock epitomized the septic tank of a show that was Raw. Said that 900 shows was great, because of course they have to say that. But for 900 Raws, they'd been promoting poor family values. He made a joke about Katie Vick, saying, if you don't know what that means, Google it, and then you'll start drinking, and then you can come to me, and I can help you. Said that he was going to show four horrible non-family-friendly events. The first was Property Damage, which was Orton Triple H brawling in Orton's house, which killed WrestleMania one year.
Oh, God, I didn't need to be reminded of that horrible angle.
Number two was Irresponsible and Reckless Behavior, which was Cena throwing Edge into the water after a brawl, which I barely remember.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, actually.
Said number three was Trespassing, which was when WWE invaded WCW.
That was cool.
Yeah. And number four was excessive use of alcohol via fire hose, which was a Austin beer batch, which was actually the less famous 2007 version that they showed here. And Punk said he knew the fans would pay any amount of money to see Austin come out and spray him with a hose.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Austin's music hit. Punk flipped out. Music played and played and played, and Punk cackled because he had put one over on the people. And he said he had one.
The thing is, I thought that was so minor league because, first of all, the way he kept talking about The Rock, the whole crowd started buzzing because they thought The Rock was coming out. Then they play Austin's music, and the crowd goes crazy because they think Austin's coming out. And to me, the whole segment, you know, then by the time Big Show comes out, you know, no one cared about him.
That's for sure.
And I mean, if they did it, if they played their cards right, you know, people might have cared a little bit about Big Show if they didn't, like, if he didn't come off as like, God, we thought we were going to see Rock in Austin.
He's the guy that's lame enough to actually be here.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing was, is it's like the 900th episode. You expect something special. And again, it was like the message that the real stars don't even come back for special shows.
They've moved on.
Yeah. Kind of made me feel like I needed to move on.
You know who else moved on is Brock Lesnar, although...
They showed him, too.
They showed a clip of Big Show suplexing Brock through the ring.
No, it was Brock suplexing Big Show.
Brock suplexing Big Show. Anyway, Punk said that Big Show was so fat he broke the ring, and he added, I don't know who the other guy was. Wow.
That was quite the knock, wasn't it?
They came off so lame.
Well, they came off so insecure.
Yeah. So out came Big Show, made a bunch of fat jokes about himself, did a Hulk Hogan impersonation, broke down into a brawl, Show sent them packing, and that was the end of that.
By the way, you missed that Alberto Del Rio ripped his pants when he was doing his thing with Evan Bourne.
He did.
He ripped his pants. It was hilarious. Now, as soon as I saw it, I knew these guys are going to do a really good job of shooting around it. And they did a pretty good job, but there were three or four scenes where you could see it.
Oops.
But it could have been worse. I mean, it's like that's almost like a Shockmaster moment when, you know this guy you're trying to get over is this big killer heel goes out there and rips his pants.
Well, he's sprawling in slacks, for crying out loud. He should rip his pants.
Yeah, you're probably right. Or he should wear looser pants.
Or he could do that, yes. Clips of Triple H beating the shit out of Angle in 2002, of course. Sheamus did a promo and talked about how Triple H was not there because of him. Sorry to say, he was never coming back, so obviously he's coming back at any time. Said he was being punished by having to defend against five guys at Night of the Champions. Out came Edge. He did essentially a babyface promo. People cheered him. But that, of course, led to a match where, well, the match was Cena, Jericho, Sheamus, Edge, and Orton against Wade, Otunga, Heath, Michael Tarver, and Justin Gabriel. Jericho immediately got counted out. Edge immediately threw down the ref for the DQ, so they both eliminated...
The count out was... You should say the count out. He just walked out of the ring.
Yeah, just left.
He just left.
Yep.
So to make it so, and then Edge threw down the ref, so they made it 5-3 immediately.
Yeah. So Cena hopped in, beat up Tarver, tagged in Sheamus. Sheamus then proceeded to play babyface. He ran wild on all the heels. They got heat on him. Fans had no idea what to make of this. And then he's making a minor little comeback on his own, and suddenly Gabriel hits him with an enziguri. Slater hits a zigzag, and Heath Slater pinned Sheamus.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
I'll say.
Jeez.
It'd be one thing if they'd all hit a finisher on him or something like that, but it was like one enziguri and then a goofy move, and they pinned the world champion. So.
And they didn't even make a big deal out of it.
No, it was just like, Sheamus is pinned.
Let's move on.
This failed. So then...
Shouldn't Barrett have been the one to pin the world champion, given that he's actually in the title match, as opposed to Slater, who's never getting a title match?
And he didn't even lead to the finish.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was not a fan of that particular aspect of it. So Cena got in the ring, made a comeback, pinned Slater with the FU. Barrett went after Cena. They beat on him forever. He finally caught Otunga in the STF, got the submission. And as soon as he got the submission, he rolled off, and he rolled his way right into the 450 by Gabriel for the pin. That was cool. So they eliminated John Cena. Orton immediately pinned Gabriel and Tarver, both with the RKO. And immediately after pinning Tarver, he turned around to Barrett, who hit him with his finisher, the waist disposal or whatever.
Wasteland or something.
For the pin. And that was that. I actually liked the booking of the last 2 minutes or so of this particular match.
Well, I mean, that was the booking they should have done for the SummerSlam match.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it was fine. It was good.
So, yeah, thumbs up to the finish of that particular match. And show in general, hit and miss Raw, wasn't horrible. A lot of stuff that left you kind of scratching your head, but I've certainly seen far worse. And we had a replay of Bob Barker, which is always a little welcome touch right there. So that was Raw.
And clips from China.
That's right. We had some clips from China as well. We got to talk about what, by my count, would be at least the 11th death in the past 2 weeks.
Oh,
J.C. Bailey.
God. Yeah. It's ridiculous. We actually should talk about Mickey as well.
About who?
Mickey Garagiola.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Because he died after our last show.
That's right. Mickey Garagiola passed away 88 or 89, I've seen both,
yeah.
But he had a battle with cancer. He was the longtime voice of St. Louis Wrestling alongside Larry Matisic for, I think, longer than Raw's been on the air, actually.
Not quite. He would have started in 69, and he would have gone through 83, so it's 14 years.
14 years, almost
as
long.
But as far as... he was probably involved in wrestling longer than Raw was on the air because, I mean, he was still doing stuff, you know, like this year.
Yeah, he was going out with Larry to all the book signings. And
I mean,
and
he ring announced at shows still.
Yep.
So, yeah, he's been, you know, he was the older brother of Joe Garagiola, who was, you know, in the 70s, one of the biggest television celebrities in the country. And he grew up on the Hill in St. Louis, which was an Italian neighborhood, which, you know, a lot of famous athletes came from there. He grew up with Yogi Berra, who old-time baseball fans would know was one of the legendary catchers in Major League Baseball. And he was a big-time baseball fan. Of course, his brother Joe has played for the Cardinals and was the first television announcer at wrestling at the Chase. And then he came after Joe had become a big national star. He started as the ring announcer and later... ended up as the color guy, and he was not, he wasn't like a great color guy, but I guess the way to say it is it worked, you know, and so, I mean, that's the basic thing. I think one of the funnier stories was there was a match, it was Harley Race when he was world champion, this is in 78, Harley Race is world champion, and Bulldog Bob Brown is on Wrestling with the Chase against Paul Orndorff and Ted DiBiase. And Ted DiBiase pinned Harley Race, I believe, with a German suplex. And it was in a tag. And Mickey got so excited.
Harley was the champion at the time.
Harley was the world champion. Mickey got so excited that he grabbed the mic and goes, "And the winner and new world champion, Ted DiBiase." And the place went crazy, even though it made absolutely no sense. And this was not planned. But it turned out to be like this spectacular moment because... even though Mickey had to like later say, "I got so excited and I said the wrong thing and I screwed up," when Ted DiBiase then got his title match with Harley Race, it was like a big deal.
And then we have the passing of J.C. Bailey, who was an independent star on the East Coast. He broke into the business when he was a teenager and ended up working for his father and then went on to work for CZW and IWA Mid-South. He was a small guy, high flyer, but then when he went to CZW and IWA Mid-South, he got into the ultra-violent stuff and ended up best known, I guess, as an extreme hardcore wrestler and did a lot of really, really crazy things and ended up getting into a lot of trouble, both with drugs and ended up, I guess he was caught with cocaine and served a prison term. And then when he got out, he tried to steal a TV, got caught. It was a probation violation, 2 more years in prison, and got out. Always came back to wrestling and always had a lot of problems with drugs. And he passed away on Sunday and I believe had just gotten out of rehab. He was 27 years old, so another... I guess another perhaps classic wrestling death. We don't know everything about it yet, but certainly most of those...
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So that would have been number 11 in the past 2 weeks that I'm aware of. And actually 12 if you count the guy that was killed during training,
oh,
or
dear
died
God,
during
yeah.
training. I'd not even added that one to the list. So 12 in the past 2 weeks. It's been a I don't think there's ever been a period like this.
I remember I once wrote 7 obituaries in one issue of the Observer. So it's 7 in 1 week, but I'm sure that the next week I didn't write 5 more. So
yeah.
Probably never been a week. I mean, like the one thing is that a lot of the deaths that we're talking about, like Mickey Garagiola and Anton Giesink, tough Tony Bourne. I mean, you know, they were people who lived full long lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously J.C. Bailey and to an extent Luna Vachon. And, you know, obviously, like Lance Cade, it's a different story.
Yeah. And actually, really, I mean, if we're at, you know, if we're talking 11 and we've only got 3 that are your classic wrestling deaths, I mean, it could be significantly worse.
Yeah.
And Luna, I guess the update from TMZ is that she was found and in the house was OxyContin. Some powder. They didn't even specify what the powder was, but there was powder and a snorting straw and
lots of different painkillers.
Lots of painkillers, that's right. So not looking good as far as what the cause of death was. Whether it was an accidental overdose, a suicide, we don't know. And really, you know, at this point, we may never know. But that's the latest on Luna Vachon. TNA next week preempted, and I guess the question is, do you know why?
They're doing some sort of a marathon or something, you know.
Hmm. So
that
there is
came out a couple weeks ago, but I hadn't really thought about it until today.
Yeah, there is actually a pay-per-view this weekend, everybody. There's a TNA pay-per-view, and then they will follow it up with nothing. So week off, and then
wow, they're doing a pay-per-view over Labor Day weekend.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good idea. It doesn't. I guess it really doesn't matter.
I won't even be around because I'll be at Bola.
Yeah, wow. Well, I'll be around. I'm going to watch it, but
yeah.
I was kind of looking forward to no pay-per-views this weekend and only watching the next Dragon Gate pay-per-view.
I wish TNA would get their shit in order.
Try to watch in the next couple days.
I wish TNA would figure out what the hell they were doing because it is not good when I miss Impact last week and I don't care at all, and I'm going to miss the pay-per-view coming up this Sunday, and I don't care at all. It should never be like that.
Yeah, I don't really care about the pay-per-view, and you know, it's the first Kurt Angle-Jeff Hardy match, at least in TNA, and I think I'd be a lot more excited if it was last year's Jeff Hardy against any year's Kurt Angle, but this year's Jeff Hardy against Kurt Angle. It'll probably be a great match anyway, but I Jeff Hardy's managed to, definitely lessen my interest in seeing him at this point.
I mean, to be fair, I could probably miss SmackDown most weeks and not be terribly disappointed about it. But, I mean, even this week, it's like I would be interested to see what the follow-up is for Alberto Del Rio. So that's something that I can say, you know, I want to see the show and see what they do with that. But just never feel that way about Impact.
Yeah, well, I mean, Impact this week was, you know, there was more, I think there was more good than bad. I thought the show was pretty good. I mean, God knows that Generation Me Machine Guns match killed anything on Raw tonight. I mean, you know, I mean, it killed it like a brutal, you know, brutal murder, you know? I mean, geez. I mean, because there was nothing. I mean, I guess the elimination match wasn't bad, but when you have 8 falls in 11 minutes or some number like that, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of rushing. But, I mean, it wasn't too bad of a show at all. You know, but do they do anything to get you excited for the pay-per-view? No, not really.
Let's do a couple of the mailbag questions here before we wrap it up today. This person here has a question on draws and Linda McMahon. What's up with the draws? I remember you had a weekly column on WWE.com. Is he still with the company in some capacity? If not, does WWE still pay him and or his medical costs?
There was a lawsuit that he filed against them, and I don't know, you know, how it was settled, so I don't know the answer to that. He was working for them. I don't believe he's working for them anymore. He had stopped working for them. I guess they had taken him off of contract or whatever, you know, maybe probably before he sued them. And then for a period, they let him write some stuff on the website for a while. But I don't know that he's doing. I don't think he's been done that for a while either.
This person wants to know, do you think Strikeforce will offer James Toney enough money to do a freak show match?
I don't think that they're looking in that direction at all. And if I was them, I would. There's no point.
Yeah.
That was one and done. I mean, if he had showed up in shape, if he had won, you know, it'd been a different story, but neither happened. And
how about James Toney and Kimbo Slice?
Kimbo didn't want that fight. That was proposed at remember when they wanted to do that show head to head with the April show?
Uh-huh.
That was the main event that Dana was trying to put together, was James Toney and Kimbo Slice, and Kimbo didn't want any part of that match.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kimbo beat Ray Mercer.
I guess. I don't know what the deal was.
This person says, what do you think Husky Harris did wrong or did not have that prevented him from making the final three? McGillicuddy did not show as much personality as Husky and was just another bland big guy. Husky stood out. What do you think prevented him from making the finals? He was a heel, but so was Riley, and Riley made it to the end. I don't think it matters much, to be honest with you. I mean, and even if it does, there's no reason for us to think that it should, since last season was all about winner gets a title shot and everyone else is eliminated, and every single one of them ended up on Raw, and Wade never got his title shot, although he is now. So I don't know why anybody would care about this at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it may have been, 50% of the vote really is the fans, and I'm guessing that, you know, the fans saw the fat guy and, you know, weren't impressed. And he was a heel. And, you know, the heels don't get a lot of votes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going to get the votes a babyface is going to get. I mean, so.
This person says, I was wondering if you guys had any news or information about Dan Henderson's MMA future. Does Strikeforce have any future plans for him, or could he go back to the UFC?
He's supposed to fight soon, and the last I heard, they were looking at Babalu as his opponent. So that match may take place between now and the end of the year.
This person here says, I've often heard crazy stories of how Ken Shamrock would run his school and even subject his fighters to frat-style hazing. Is there any truth to this? And if so, what type of abuse would he put his fighters through? Specifically, he says. He beat them up.
I couldn't give you specifics, but it was the stuff that he learned from Japan. I mean, in a sense, I mean, it's the same stuff that they would do at a power plant or something like that. I mean, it was, he'd bring the guys in and make them do calisthenics like crazy. And if they quit, you know, or couldn't perform, he would just think they weren't tough enough to be fighters and he would send them home. But it wasn't like, I mean, I'm not saying that it was right or wrong, you know, the way to do it. I think a lot of people would say it's the wrong way, but it was that was the mentality that, you know, if you're mentally tough and you can do your 500 squats or you know, survive and not quit, then you're tough enough to be a fighter. And that may not be the right way to look at it, but that was the kind of stuff he would do. It wasn't as much, I haven't heard really as much other stuff at all, really. Just that very difficult, you know, things that he made you do to prove you were worthy of being trained by him.
This person says, I'm on the East Coast. I honestly cannot stay awake to watch UFC pay-per-views when they start at 10 p.m. Why is the start time at 10 for the Boston show? Why not 8 or even 9 at the latest?
Well, it's a throwback to, believe it or not, when they first got the contract to get back on the air in 2001, the cable companies, because there was so much controversy about bringing them back, they decreed that they didn't want them on until 10 o'clock so kids wouldn't watch, even though it's 7 o'clock on the East Coast, I mean, on the West Coast. I mean, the whole thing is preposterous. So that's the reason, and then it just became the traditional starting time. Plus, when they finally started getting real popular, they were really, you know, more of a West Coast thing. So on the West Coast, it's 7 to 10, and they figured that, you know, it's, you know, starting at 6, you might lose some West Coast viewers as compared to 7. And, you know, they weren't getting so much on the East. So it just became their traditional time. And boxing, you know, their big fights usually go in the ring around, I mean, they'll go in the ring between 11 and midnight on Saturday nights, as far as on pay-per-view usually. So, you know, and that's kind of what they, in a sense, what they copy out of. But yeah, the basic deal is from 10 years ago that the cable companies wouldn't let them go any earlier.
I think they should start at 7 o'clock no matter where they are. 7 p.m. if they're in the Pacific time zone, 5 p.m. if Pacific if they're on the Eastern time zone, which would mean 7 Eastern. This 10 to 1 is not a fan.
No, but you know what, though? I would disagree because you're primarily making your money on pay-per-view and you want a consistent starting time. It's like when WWE comes here, they're not going to start at 8 o'clock here because that would be 11 o'clock on pay-per-view. That's where your money is. You want a I think you want a consistent time.
Fine, do 9 always... Eastern for every show. 9 what? Eastern. 9 Eastern.
I used to think that 9 Eastern and 6 Pacific would be better, and it probably would because... I mean, you know what? It doesn't matter because if you have a pay-per-view and people want to see it, you know, unless it's on like at 3 in the morning or something, they will see it. You know, like WWE forever has been on at 5 o'clock on Sunday nights here on the West Coast. And I don't think that it stops anyone from buying the pay-per-view, that it's on at 5. I mean, they do a replay at usually like 8:30 or 9. But, you know, no one, I don't know anyone who watches the replay. Maybe you do, but that's about it. So, you know, whatever the consistent time is, I kind of think an hour earlier would be better. But, you know, for that exact reason, you know, you're asking your East Coast people to stay up until 1 a.m. on Saturday. But I think that they think most of their fans, you know, at the age that their fans are perfectly willing to stay up until 1 a.m. to watch. So I don't think it's killing them in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, as far as could you make the argument moving up an hour would be better? Yeah, you know, because it was what I used to think when the thing was first breaking out. I would think that same thing. It's like, you know, make it 9 o'clock on the East Coast and 6 o'clock on the West Coast. So the, you know, because more people do live on the East Coast than anywhere else, and you know, I think it's easier to keep them up until midnight than one.
I will say, for purely selfish reasons, that after this Saturday night, ending at 1 a.m. is bullshit.
God, in the live city, it's really difficult, especially when you have a city that closes up early. Like in Montreal, it's really not a big deal because Montreal, everything's open. I mean, after the shows, I mean, you know, I would go out, we'd go out to eat in Montreal at 3 a.m. and there's places open, so it's not a big deal. In Boston, you don't have that.
Actually, you know, Boston, in Boston, it was worse.
There were no big post-show parties. Dana didn't even have a party to go to after
the
press conference.
That's not even the big deal. Forget the parties. The tram... shut down.
Tram, yeah, there you go.
The tram shut down before the show was over, number one. And number two, the parking garage shut down at 1 a.m., so people got out of the building and the parking garage was closed.
Well, only people who stayed long because the show did end, but if the show had gone the whole 3 hours, yeah, the potential was there that the parking garage would be shut down. But that's a different story. That's the parking garage's fault. If the show's going to end at 1, they should know that the show's going to end at 1.
Yeah.
No, that's a different issue. UFC can't be, you know, worrying about that. But, for Boston, yeah, there were a lot of good reasons why it would have been a better show had it ended, you know, an hour earlier. But, you know, their money is on pay-per-view, and whatever it is, it's got to be a consistent time because you don't want to confuse your audience.
And that's going to do it for today, everybody. But we have a lot of things coming up. There's a brand new issue of Figure Four that is coming out tomorrow. And starting this week, there's going to be Kindle versions of Figure Four. We're going to put those up as well for those of you that have electronic reading devices of various types. So you'll be able to check that out. We've also got a bunch of big Figure Four dailies coming up. We're going to have Conan on the show with Dr. Lucha Steve Sims on Wednesday. On Thursday, Todd Martin and I will be joined by Jim Cornette. And tomorrow on the show, Shooter Tony Jones is on the program. That should be a very fun time. So a lot of stuff coming up. New issue of The Observer out on Wednesday as well. So make sure you check that out. And we shall talk to you again after a while.